Hi, this is Sarah. If you like this episode of Let's Talk About Sects, you can listen to my audiobook, Do As I Say, How Cults Control, Why We Join Them, and What They Teach Us About Bullying, Abuse and Coercion. The audiobook will be available on Audible, Apple Books, Google and Kobo from the 28th of June. A link is in the show notes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Dr. John Hunter is a South African researcher and lecturer based in Johannesburg. His interest in large group awareness trainings, or LGATs, and their impact on mood and psychosis is grounded in his personal experience of bipolar disorder and his own participation in an LGAT in 2010. In 2017, John completed a PhD in psychology at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, proposing a neurobiological explanation for the relationship between LGAT conditions and results. He put forward a hypothesis that offers insight into both the transformational experiences associated with LGAT participation and the common claims of psychological harm and problematic behaviour associated with participation. In 2023, John presented this work at the annual International Cultic Studies Association conference in Louisville, Kentucky, and today he breaks down some of his findings for Let's Talk About Sects. Welcome to Let's Talk About Sects, a podcast about cults around the world. I'm your host, Sarah Steele. Before we get into this episode, a content warning. This podcast deals with issues that some people may find disturbing related to emotional abuse and controlling behaviours. This episode also discusses sexual abuse, incest, and suicide, and has a little coarse language. Please use your discretion as to whether this will be suitable for you and those around you who may be listening to. As someone who spends a lot of time researching cults, I've been asked a few times about various LGATs and whether they qualify as cultic. Friends who feel they benefited from a seminar also felt the pressure to bring others along and wondered about what they saw as some problematic elements of the courses. Dr. John Hunter has looked into these types of trainings in depth, and his work tackles them from a psychological perspective that certainly helped me to understand why they seem to create so-called breakthroughs for so many participants, in spite of the fact that no peer-reviewed studies have found their benefits to be at all lasting.
John, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. First up, can you give us a brief overview of what large group awareness training is, and perhaps give us a few examples of LGATs that listeners may have heard of?
Sure. Hi, Sarah. Yeah, so when you think about what a large group awareness training is, these are what were initially described as personal development type trainings. They became popular sort of in the early 1970s and 1980s. They tend to last for, you know, between 3 to 5 days. They tend to have very long hours, so usually starting at sort of 9 in the morning, carrying on until, you know, 10, 11, 12, sometimes 1, 2 in the morning. They involve a number of sort of exercises and interactions, which we can kind of go into in a bit more detail. And in terms of the ones, the organizations that have been described as large group awareness trainings or LGATs in the past, you'd be thinking of organizations like EST, which stands for Erhardt Seminars Trainings, Lifespring, Actualizations, PsyWorld, and then more recently, seminars like the Forum, the Landmark Forum. These are some of the seminars or groups that have been described as LGATs.
Sure. And talk me through the typical stages that participants will be subject to in an LGAT seminar.
Okay, I mean, I think maybe what you're trying to get at here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is how would you recognize an LGAT? And I think that it kind of goes beyond just what happens in the seminar. There are a couple of things around it that allow you to kind of see that maybe you're being invited to an LGAT or taking part in one. The first thing is that you'll probably be invited by a family member or a friend or a work colleague or sometimes a manager. And often with a manager, it's not so much an invite as it is insistence that you take part. Often when you're invited, they may say, "Will you come to my graduation evening?" And so that's something to look out for. If you're invited to a graduation evening, typically on a Tuesday evening, the seminars, the sort of main part of the seminar tends to end on a Sunday evening. And then, people are asked to go and recruit or enroll family, friends, and whatever by Tuesday evening. And then you'll arrive and you'll realize, okay, this kind of is a graduation, but also there's quite a hard sales that takes place at that time. They'll also not tell you anything about what happens in the seminar. And that's a very important factor. So typically participants will be told it will spoil it for your family member or friend or whatever if they know about what's going to happen. So, and we'll get into this a little bit later on, but the first rule of large group awareness training is that you don't talk about large group awareness training. So they won't give you any detail. They'll probably just say, "Trust me, you need to take part. It's amazing. The experience is fantastic. You need to just trust me and trust the process." So that's how people are generally introduced. When you arrive at the seminar, so if you decide to sign up, you'll often have to put down a deposit. And then, a couple of weeks later, or maybe a few months later, depending on the seminar, you'll arrive. It'll probably be in a hotel, a room booked out in a hotel, sometimes in a school or something like that. When you go into the room, they're going to be rows of very neatly placed chairs. So these kind of rows of chairs, often very close to each other. There tends to be a stage or a platform or a lectern or something like that. And this is where the leader is going to speak from. What else can I say about these seminars that's quite consistent? So you'll arrive probably at about 9, I guess, in the morning. The first thing that will happen is that the leader or some of the assistants, and this is another sort of telltale sign of an LGAT, is that there'll be a number of assistants kind of sitting in the back or around the sides. They'll be doing things like taking notes, passing the microphone around. Sharing is a very important part of what takes place in these things. And these people will almost without question be doing it as volunteers. They won't be getting paid. The only person in the room that tends to be getting paid is the seminar leader. Yeah, so for the first couple of hours of the LGAT, what often happens is that the leader or one of these volunteers, although they sometimes insist that they're referred to as assistants, not volunteers, will basically read out a number of rules that participants need to agree to in order to participate. And this can take quite a long time. So these are things like the way that you're communicated with. So if you want to say anything, you need to raise your hand. Somebody will bring you a microphone. When you're acknowledged, you can stand up. Then you can share. And so this already creates a kind of sense of control. Other rules that are typically in place, participants are not allowed to take any notes. And there's a very important reason for that we can speak about later. So you're not allowed to take any notes. Participants are told that they shouldn't be taking any sort of drugs or alcohol during the length of the training. And again, there are important reasons for that. You can't talk to anyone next to you. You can't talk to anyone behind you. You can't communicate with anyone while you're in the environment. There's a lot of pressure to stay in the environment. So in the past, there was a fair amount of evidence and a lot of claims that you could not get up and leave the room. Some of the modern LGATs or the descendants of the earlier LGATs will claim that was never really a rule, but there seems to at least be some controversy over that. Today, what most of the LGATs will will do is they'll say, you can leave the room. However, if you leave the room, you've got no right to expect the transformation that comes at the end. And I think that's maybe another really important thing, is that the thing that these organizations are promising is some sort of transformation, a shift in the way that you see the world, a shift in your reality. So as opposed to offering sort of academic education, what they are offering is experiential education. And often these seminars are referred to as experiential trainings. And my research provides an explanation for what that experiential shift is. So, and, you know, there are questions about whether these seminars can cause harm to some people. And I believe that the very nature of the education, and I say that in inverted commas, that they're providing, there's good reason to believe that if you're providing a transformation or a shift in reality in the way that that it is being provided, that you are going to end up with some people that respond badly to that process. What else can I tell you? So yeah, the seminars kind of run over from about 9 off until 10, 12, 2 in the morning. Typically, the participants are given homework as well. So very long hours. The sessions tend to last from 2 to 3 hours, limited breaks. Participants are expected to do things during those limited breaks. And then at the end of the day, you know, often they've got to drive home. They've got to, you know, get back to their hotels if they've come in from out of town. And on top of that, they're expected to do homework. So over a period of 3 or 4 or 5 days, you're finding people that are getting very tired, overloaded with information. A lot of information that's provided is quite philosophically obscure. So a lot of jargon, a lot of words being redefined or explained in ways that you haven't heard them before. So it's not easy to understand it. There's a lot of information. You can't write anything down. You can't speak to anyone next to you. There's very little time for reflection. And so you've got quite a challenging environment to deal with for a number of days.
Yes, and I think when I was reading some of your work, there was something about the stages of the process. It goes through different stages, and that might feed a bit into my next question, which is that you write about how stresses are magnified during the process. So at the same time, participants' access to their usual stress reduction mechanisms is limited. And can you give me some examples of how that works in these situations?
Okay, perfect. And I think what you're referring to is kind of a more macro explanation of what takes place over the seminars. So in my view, the general structure of the seminars is sort of 70-80% of it is incredibly stressful, and we'll go through some of the ways that stress is generated. And then typically on the final day, the stress is removed and replaced with a sense of love and acceptance and affirmation, and you've graduated and you're wonderful, and that sort of thing. So for your listeners who are familiar with Robert J. Lifton's work, Chapter 22, he speaks about the 8 conditions of thought reform. And he also speaks about the switch between assault and leniency. So there's a period of assault and then a period of leniency. And the 8th condition of thought reform is dispensing of existence. So this is when people move from non-people to people. And a lot of the descriptions of what goes on in some of these seminars is that participants are referred to as assholes. They are really made to feel like they are lacking something for the first period of the training, so the first 70-80%. And then at the end, they've graduated, they're amazing, they're one of us, they're wonderful. The trainer steps down from the platform and says, you know, we're exactly the same now, you're on the same level as me. So you have this really overt switch from you guys are terrible to you guys are wonderful. So that's the sort of the macro explanation for or description of what takes place in most of these seminars. In terms of specific things that go on in terms of generating stress, I did take some notes down, so let me maybe just find those very quickly.
While you're looking for those, I think the ones that I came across when I was looking into some of these organizations were things like the temperature being either really too hot or too cold. And I think you wrote about how you're never allowed to sit next to the same person. So it's like taking levels of comfort away, but I'm sure you have more than those.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we speak about thought reform and the conditions of thought reform, milieu control is environment control. And so you would ask yourself the question, well, is there environment control and is there control of communication going on? And we can certainly chat about that. So, and let's first run through the way that stresses are magnified, and then we can maybe speak about some of the ways that the ways to mitigate stress are removed from participants, or at least are minimized. So Lifton spoke about a demand for purity as one of his conditions. So essentially establishing, you know, these arbitrary standards of purity. So this is what you should be doing, and then holding people up against those standards and kind of saying you're not meeting the standards that we have established. And what you typically see in LGATs is a focus on what they refer to as integrity and responsibility and commitment. And the integrity might relate to the rules that they've set. And the rules are often very difficult to kind of follow. And then if people fail to follow all of these rules perfectly, the trainer will often harass them and say, well, look at you, you don't have any integrity, you aren't following these rules. Or they'll get people to agree right at the beginning that they're going to stay for the duration of the training. And then if people start saying, well, hold on a second, there's some problems with what I see going on, they'll say, oh, you said at the beginning you were going to stay, and you also said that you're going to be coachable, or that you were going to participate fully, and now you're not doing those things. What sort of person are you that you can't kind of keep to your commitments? A very big thing that you see in, you know, all the LGATs that I've looked at is this idea of responsibility. And again, this seems like something wonderful. Of course, you should be responsible for yourself. You should take accountability. But the way that responsibility is communicated in these seminars and the things that participants are asked to take responsibility for, it's done in a very bizarre way. And I would kind of compare it to, you know, it's a very crude and poorly executed form of cognitive therapy. That's how I would describe it. In cognitive therapy, the idea is, you know, if you look at rational emotive behavioral therapy, which is Albert Ellis from the 1950s, which far preceded these trainings, or if you look at Aaron Beck, Albert Ellis in particular, he said, for example, there are activating events, and then there are beliefs about those events, and then there are consequences. And it's, we don't have an emotional response to the event. We have an emotional response to the belief that we have about that event. So if we change our belief about the event, we're going to change the emotional consequences. So in these organizations, they'll say there's an event, and then there's a story about the event. And then based on your story about the event, you're going to have particular consequences. So they've literally, as far as I can tell, are using the ABC concept from Albert Ellis, but instead of a belief about it, they've got a story about it, which to me is very much the same thing. But they will say to people who have been raped that it's just your interpretation that's, you know, causing you this sort of problem. They'll say to people that have been molested, you weren't actually molested. You're putting your own spin. There was something that happened, and this is just the way that you're describing this. And I can read you some actual examples of this to maybe help illustrate.
I think some examples would be really good, and it really does make me think of a lot of things that I see in cultic groups for sure, because this sense of personal responsibility, you know, as you say, it sounds good on its surface. I think we all do need to take personal responsibility for many things, but when it's at the expense of holding someone to account who has been abusive towards you, like, it just, it's shocking to me that people could even think to frame it that way.
And I mean, I think this is what people will find difficult, because as an outsider, when you hear about these things and you read them, and I'm not entirely an outsider, I've taken part in an LGAT, and I've seen people being spoken to like this, and then I've seen them at the end kind of going, that was the greatest thing ever. And that it's so bizarre to see, you know, rationally, this is what you see, what's going on, and then afterwards you see people responding to it in a particular way. So I'll read something here. So this is from Mark Brewer. So he was a journalist who was writing for Psychology Today in 1975, and he's referring to EST, and he's referring to an interaction between Tony, the trainer, and participants. So he says, it's your fault. Gradually, Tony moved on to another mainstay in the S body of knowledge, the idea of taking responsibility for your life. It is basically the perception that your problems aren't caused by sickness or fate or other people. They are caused by you. And until you accept that, you'll never solve any of them. Not surprisingly, almost everyone in the room had an example of some exception in his own case, but Tony would have none of it. He wouldn't have cared if he'd been gang raped or born with a brain defect. It was no goddamn excuse. So this is a guy in 1975, and then somebody might say, well, you know, this is some biased journalist. So I can read you a slightly longer interaction from a book called The Book of Est. So this was written by somebody named Luke Reinhardt. Well, that was his pen name in 1976. It was republished in 2010. And the foreword is written by Werner Erhard. Erhard, who was the founder of Est, basically says, I support Luke Reinhardt entirely. This gives a great idea of what goes on in the training. So this is an interaction between an S trainer and a participant. So this is this person speaking. She says, when Don asked us to contact an image from the past, I got the time when I was 10 years old and my uncle molested me. I've remembered this incident ever since it occurred. It wasn't something I had repressed. I was playing on my uncle's lap when my parents were out and he began doing dirty things with his hands and then making me do dirty things with mine. When I, and then she's interrupted. Hold it, Diane. Don interrupts. Dirty things is your belief system, your concept. It's something you just added then and are adding now to what actually occurred. Diane stares at Don, at first without replying. I was only 10 years old, she says. I got that, says Don. And your uncle touched your right elbow, is that right? No, he touched me between the legs. Good, I got it. Go on. Well, says Diane, now a little flushed. He molested me and later I realized what I had done wrong. My mother, I'm sorry, Diane, interrupts Don again. This coming weekend, when we talk about reality and who did it, you'll understand why I want you to look now at who is making what you and your uncle did dirty or wrong. Everybody does. It was dirty, says Diane. You choose to experience it as dirty, says Don, standing on the platform opposite Diane. Look, in a graduate seminar, a woman shared that for 4 years she had committed incest with her father and she felt terrible about it. There was incest and there was her feeling terrible about it. Immediately after that woman finished sharing, another woman stood up and said, I just realized, listening to this woman, how much I loved my father and part of me wished my father had committed incest with me. It almost seems like it would have been wonderful. Now, it's not that one woman is right and the other is wrong. What I want you to get is that the same physical event can be experienced as dirty or wonderful. So this is something that's endorsed as being, this is a totally fine way of viewing these things. And you might say, okay, well, that was that organization that was in the 1970s or whatever. So here's a very brief quote from somebody who took part in a similar organization in 2009. And so this person, it was just a person writing on the internet, said, basically, the leader had people stand up and share stories which were heartbreaking. One woman's kid was run over by a car. And as she sobbed, people weren't allowed to comfort her. This guy wasn't a shrink, and he kept telling her that she was responsible for her pain due to the meaning she placed on the incident. And now we've got Roland Howard from the Daily Mail. So this is in 2001 in London. And he's again referring to one of the organizations that's still around now. And he says, but it's only on the second day when a young man comes to the microphone that my misgivings turn to anger. He tells us with tears streaming down his face that he had been raped by his brother, for most of his childhood. He had taken David's advice the day before and phoned his brother to create a breakthrough. I was willing to give up the pain for a good relationship, he says. His brother had put down the phone. David urges him to phone again. Rape is interpretation. Brutality is interpretation, he says. He had to forgive him. Get off your guilt and grow up, he snaps. And just one last one, just to show that this is not, these are not trainers going rogue. Here's an example from Paris in France. So this is Marie Lemonnier, and also a journalist. I think the magazine is Le Nouveau Observateur, and I'm sure that I'm butchering that pronunciation. So she says, one day Francois, 60 years old, dared to talk about having been sexually abused as a child. Martha, the trainer that day, retorted that not all children get themselves abused. Faced with an argument, Martha persisted. Identity is formed at the age of two. We bring these things into our lives. It's the way of being you adopt that determines whether these things happen to you or not. And again, you can read my PhD. I think from a page 192 to 318, which is a lot of information, I've got more than 120 unique sources that describe very similar things consistently going on. So this is not random occurrences. This is not occasions where participants would have all left those seminars and gone, wow, that was terrible. I know, I've been in one of these seminars or a very similar seminar, and I've seen the horrific things that the trainers have said to participants. I've seen people breaking down, crying, screaming, that sort of thing. And then afterwards, they feel absolutely amazing, and they feel like the experience was great and wonderful and that sort of thing. And that to me was obviously very fascinating because, you know, it doesn't really make sense, right?
I mean, it's just really shocking stuff. And it doesn't sound like this should be a relief or a positive experience for anyone. But I guess you're tying the way that the trainers would talk to any situation that anyone put forward and try and put it back on that person. That kind of comes out in these extreme examples for people who have experienced some really awful things in their life.
Yeah, and I mean, we can again go back to Lifton's conditions of thought reform. So what you see here is the sacred science, so which I think is the fifth of his conditions. This idea that you've got this philosophy or way of looking at things and it's applicable in every situation. So a trained psychologist is going to sit with the person and kind of be like, okay, if I do want to change the way that you think about a situation, if I want you to reframe things in a different way, I'm going to work with you individually. I'm going to know how hard I can kind of push you. I'm going to do it relatively gently. I'm going to gradually get you to move to a new way of seeing things. And there's some things that I don't think any psychologist would say to a person, well, that actually wasn't a bad thing. You're just interpreting as a bad thing. But the application of this philosophy is so extreme that in every circumstance, it's applied. The other thing that you see, which is, again, one of Lifton's conditions, is doctrine over person. So this is the idea that you take your philosophy and your way of viewing the world and you apply it to an individual. And the individual who may see something in a particular way is so sort of overwhelmed by your imposition that they start to view their own reality in the way that you've kind of imposed it. And you see this over and over again. And they may refer to these things as breakthroughs. Okay, you've suddenly started seeing things in the right way. But it seems like people's ability to think for themselves is being undermined. So their ability to make sense of what's going on is being undermined by somebody who's had no interaction with them really, other than, you know, when the microphone is passed to them. That's the first time they start having an interaction. Again, it's not like a therapist who develops a relationship, understands the background, really gets to know the person. It's just very quickly kind of saying, this is actually the right way for you to see that circumstance that I wasn't a part of, that I don't really understand. It was definitely your fault or your responsibility. And they may never say your fault, but I think that comes through quite clearly. Yeah.
Well, yeah, if it's all about your reaction and that's the thing that you can change, it's hard not to kind of take that to mean it's your fault. The way that you are reacting is incorrect. And it kind of feeds over into this whole sort of coaching industry and how you've got people who don't have any particular qualifications. I mean, it just sounds so psychologically dangerous to me, and we can get into that in a little bit as well. Just stepping back to the bigger picture, how many of these organizations are out there and what kind of scale of operations are we talking about?
Well, in 1998, Michael Langoni, who was for a long time the head of the International Cultic Studies Association, he estimated that there were hundreds worldwide. I don't necessarily know how easy it is to work this out. I mean, just from my interaction with people, I'll have somebody contacting me from Hong Kong and saying, oh, there's this thing called Asia Works, and it's exactly the same as everything that I've described. And then somebody called me from obscure parts of the US. I had somebody from Bulgaria contacting me the other day and saying, you know, I've found your work and we've got one of these things in our city as well. So they seem to be everywhere. And because they don't say I'm a large group awareness training, they always call themselves something different. They always claim to be doing something unique, which is quite hilarious when you actually look at the exact same exercises being done in these, in a lot of these organizations, particularly the ones that's evolved from LifeSpring. You see exactly the same exercise. You see the red and black game. You see the lifeboat exercise. You see the trust exercise. You see dyad positions. You see the same piece of music being played. So the theme music from 2001, A Space Odyssey. If you hear that and you're in a conference venue, you know that you're probably in a large group awareness training. It's called also Sprague Zarathustra is the name of the piece. So there's a lot of similarity with them, but it's very difficult to really work out how common they are. And so there are lots of these organizations. Some of them are on a much smaller scale. The largest of them that I know about, and I'm sure anyone that does any research into this can figure out who that is. I'd rather not speak about them. But, you know, they've had offices in 30 countries. You know, they've had 3.5 million participants, or they claim to have 3.5 million participants of their flagship seminar. So just one organization can operate on sort of 6 continents, and there are hundreds of these organizations. So they really are everywhere.
Sure. And tell me about your own introduction to an LGAT and how this tees up with your research about how others sometimes come across them too. You've briefly mentioned this, but yeah, I'm interested in your personal experience.
Sure. So as I say, it's often a family member or friend that will invite you. And once you take part, you put under a lot of pressure to bring in other people. So that's a common way for people to be invited. The other way that it often occurs is through the organization that you're working at. So chatting to Steve Hassan, he mentioned that a lot of HR departments seem to be approached, or they'll find somebody in an HR department. And once you get a manager or a leader of an organization that becomes a fanatic, they may get their entire organization to take part. So for example, Panda Express, which is a big kind of fast food or restaurant group in the US, at one point had all of their employees or all of the head office employees taking part in some of these seminars. Lululemon, which a lot of people really, really like, also had that kind of mindset. They put their employees through. And I started working at a company in 2010 in Durban in South Africa. And as part of the induction, they said, you have to take part in these 2 personal development seminars. I said, no problem, because I didn't really know what they involved. And when I say that they won't tell you what happens, they often explain what happens using this very specific language. So they'll say, there are things that you know, there are things that you know you don't know, and then there are things that you don't know, you don't know. The seminar is about those things. So again, if you hear that description, it's a relatively good sign that you might be getting invited to a large group awareness training. And so I went and I took part in this thing, and it started at 6 in the evening on a Thursday, and it ran until 2 in the morning. So this is after work. Next day, worked a full day on Friday, then 6 in the evening till 2 in the morning. Homework on Thursday night and Friday night. Saturday started at 9 in the morning, ended at 12 at night. We got homework. And so by Sunday morning, I mean, we were completely exhausted. And then Sunday, I think, ran from 10 until maybe 6 or 7. And it was actually the World Cup final of soccer was happening in South Africa at the time. And just to give you a sense of how fanatic a lot of people are about these seminars, when people said, you know, we may miss the World Cup soccer final in South Africa, and this is like a once-in-a-lifetime, if that, sort of event, the chairman of our company said, this is more important. This is something that you really need to do. You'll thank me afterwards. And he really believed it. I mean, so that's the kind of level of fanaticism that you often see associated with these things. So, I mean, I took part in it, and I think something very relevant to my research and to my experience is the fact that I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 2003. So some of the major triggers for manic episodes in bipolar disorder, and just for those that don't really know much about it, a very basic explanation is depression is kind of a unipolar mood disorder. So you just experience the very low side. Bipolar disorder, you experience the low side and also these abnormal highs that can feel incredibly good. And so between 2003 and 2010, I had been learning about bipolar disorder and trying to manage it as well as I could. And I knew that triggers for manic episodes were psychological stress, sleep disruption, and goal attainment. So those are three sort of very well-recognized triggers. So I'm sitting in this, and because I didn't know what was going to happen, I took part and kind of thought, okay, it's going to be fine. And then I find myself in this environment, and I'm like, this is really not good for me. And I didn't want to speak to the people I was working with and say, listen, I've got this condition, because it really is highly stigmatized, and that would affect my ability to work. So I thought, well, let me just, and you don't know what's coming as well. So it's kind of like, I'm sure this will be fine, or it'll get better, or whatever. But basically, the seminar involved massive amounts of psychological stress, sleep disruption, and then on the final day, this very clear example of goal attainment, this reward, and you're wonderful, and you graduate, and whatever. And so I was sitting there, and I was thinking, okay, this is the worst conditions I could possibly be in. But then what I realized is that of the group of people that did the seminar with me, they've gone through these triggers for mania and hypomania, and they were all behaving in a way and saying things that were very much in line with the elevated states of bipolar disorder. So again, just to provide a little bit more detail, mania is the very extreme side. So this is where you often see psychosis and, you know, delusions, hallucinations, and really kind of out of control. But in bipolar disorder, you also get bipolar 2. And there you'll experience depression and then hypomania. And hypo actually means below. So hypomania is above the normal range of mood, but below mania. And this is a state that feels incredibly good. People feel high, they feel euphoric, they feel incredibly confident, productive, creative, decisive, all of these really sort of positive things. Their lens of the world shifts. They start seeing the world through rose-tinted glasses. And when I started doing research into the seminars, I realized this is exactly what these seminars promise. So if you go and you look at the promises made, it's like your life won't change objectively, but the way that you interpret life is going to change. And to me, this is like, well, this is a shift in mood. I mean, this is what, if you understand depression is when your life is objectively not necessarily that bad, but it feels terrible. You feel guilty. You feel worthless. You feel like the future is going to be negative. Hypomania is the opposite of that. So the world can be okay, or it can even be quite negative, but you feel incredibly optimistic. You feel incredibly confident and energized and productive, and, you know, you just feel alive. And the more I started looking into these seminars, the more I found, okay, well, the first thing was going and finding out that what I'd done was a large group awareness training. I thought it was a once-off thing. But you do a little bit of research and you start seeing that these exercises are everywhere, and you find your way. And they all have the same structure: stress, 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 sudden removal of stress replaced with love and affirmation, often sleep disruptions involved to greater or lesser extents. And then they have what they call a transformation or a breakthrough or a, you know, enlightenment or whatever they're describing it as. But when you look at the indicators or the symptoms of this transformation or enlightenment, it lines up perfectly with a hypomanic or even in some cases manic state. So for the last 50 years, there have also been claims of psychosis. And instead of people being decisive, they may be really impulsive. So spending huge amounts of money, taking a lot of risks financially, number of examples at a very strange rate, people getting divorced immediately after participating or quitting their jobs or changing their jobs. And so when this is done in a relatively controlled way, so you might describe it as hypomanic, you might say it's decisive and people have made some decisive decisions and it may have worked out for them. However, when it becomes more manic, you see these really sort of reckless decisions being made. But often the organizations in question will just say, well, that's not us. I mean, how can you blame us? That's just a person not applying the technology correctly. So it seems like they are counting all the hits and just ignoring all the misses from the effects of participation.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that before, and we'll come back to the psychological side of things in a little bit. But I wanted to just talk a bit about the cultic elements of LGATs. And so LGATs strongly contest the association with cults and in many cases take legal action against those who they perceive to defame them. Are they cults? And if not, why has this association been consistently made in the last 50 years?
I think the first thing that I would say is that I'm not a cult expert. That's not what my work is about. I don't even know I understand that there are multiple definitions of cults. So I certainly wouldn't make the statement that any of them are cults because I don't even really know what a cult is. I mean, maybe you could provide a definition and I could sort of work from there, but I'd rather not do that. I do think that while there may be discussion about whether there are cults or not, and they may say we're definitely not, and some people might say that they are, I think what they can't deny is that this claim has been made a lot over the last 50 or so years. I mean, if you just type the names of some of these organizations into Google, and from what I understand, Google hasn't got a vendetta against these groups, it will suggest, you know, it'll have the name of the organization and then cult or ruined my life or, you know, something like that. So I'm guessing that these are things that these organizations need to address. They can't just respond to discussion about this by saying, okay, we're going to sue you. I agree that people shouldn't make that claim without evidence, but clearly it is something that they need to address. And some of them have in the past. So they found various people who are considered authorities and they've made statements for the organization saying, I don't think that this organization is a cult, or I don't think that this organization uses brainwashing or something like that. So they are aware that this characterization is out there. Maybe just to run through some of the assertions that have been made that are maybe things that they want to look at. And again, these are things that have been made for 50 years. So, you know, if I'm somehow sued or if somehow this episode gets taken down for whatever reason, that's a pretty good indicator that they don't want us to have discussions about that, which is a problem in itself. So let's think about some of these things. Okay, so why might the claim be made? Sometimes when people think of cults, they think of kind of an all-knowing, godlike type of leader. So this person who's held in incredible esteem by the organization. And I think then the question becomes, is there a person like that at the organization that you are taking part in seminars with? And maybe scratch beneath the surface as well, because, you know, you don't find out about Xenu and Scientology until you get to a certain level. So maybe that person exists and you are not aware that person exists. So is there this person that's kind of considered, you know, supremely knowledgeable and enlightened and that sort of thing? So I'd like to read a description of a leader of one of these organizations, and I won't say what it is. Let's just call this organization the Joy Organization, and we'll call this leader David Charles. But again, this is something that was produced by the organization in question, and this is how this person was described. So what's often very interesting about people belonging to problematic groups is that they can recognize problematic leaders in other groups. They're not incapable of looking at another group and going, clearly this person's problematic. But when they look at their own group, they really struggle. So it might be useful for people to kind of listen to this and go, does this sound like this person's elevated beyond a normal human being or not, without them knowing who I'm talking about? All right, so the Joy Organization is not democratic. Most American business organizations are not, but rather authoritarian in a way that baffles many and antagonizes others. David Charles expects staff members to be dedicated to serving the Joy Enterprise, which, because he and the Joy Enterprise are one and the same, means serving him. Late in the fourth day of the training, the trainer explains that David is in essence a power source, serving masses of people, and individual staff members supply David with additional power. The power flows up from graduates and staff through David out into the world. This is a perfectly reasonable way to explain the essentially Eastern phenomenon of a powerful being, usually a guru or spiritual teacher, attracting other powerful beings who nevertheless choose to channel the power through their leader. Okay, so that's an endorsed description of their leader. Personally, I think that that's really elevating a person. The person in question, former employees have said that he claimed that he was God. You know, an external person might look at that and kind of go, that seems a little bit odd to me. But people in the organization will say, oh, it's perfectly reasonable. That's perfectly kind of fine. There's nothing strange about that. So that's the one thing, this kind of leader. I think another thing that outsiders may look at and think is problematic is exploitation of some sort. And so the claim has been made that a lot of these organizations rely very heavily on volunteer labor. So you've got people working in their call centers, calling people. You've got people staffing the seminars. You've got people doing these things. And they may feel, I'm getting something out of this. I'm getting free enlightenment or something to that effect. But for an outsider, they may see this as exploitation. And I mean, it's actually such a, it's again, it's one of these things that it's difficult to argue with the people that are doing it, because they kind of say, well, I definitely feel that I am getting value. But you can see why to an outsider that might seem a little bit cult-like. I don't know if you've ever seen the British comedy Peep Show with David Mitchell and Robert Webb. So on season 5, episode 6, Jez, one of the characters, joins a cult. And I think they're parodying Scientology there. And him and Superhands, who's one of the other characters, and they're kind of not supposed to be very bright. That's kind of the vibe that they give off. And Superhands says to Jez, he says, they've got this brilliant new system at the group that we've joined. We can live in there and we can get these free courses so we don't have to pay for it. It's a brilliant system, isn't it? And Jeremy goes, yes, what a great system. And the joke is that anyone watching should be looking and going, clearly these guys are being taken advantage of. And you kind of see the same thing in these organizations, that the people participating, they're like, oh, I'm getting this free training and whatever. But they are doing all the sales. They're doing a lot of the other work, and that can be seen as problematic. I think a third thing that people might look at and get concerned about is the level of fanaticism. So when you engage with a person about most things that they participate in, the level of defensiveness that you get about any criticism of these groups is quite extreme with a lot of participants. They're very reluctant to acknowledge issues with the organization, although a lot of them will kind of say, I don't think that the hard selling is a good thing. They'll say, I think that is problematic. But there are a lot of other aspects about it that they'll be quite unwilling to speak about. If you're a family member or friend and you haven't been involved and you've got a family member who has been, often they will speak about it sort of nonstop. They will tell you about it. They'll try to get you involved. All of the language that they use is now frequently jargon that they've used in the seminars. Their group of friends may start to become more and more only people that have been participating in the seminar, and that can cause rifts in families. So they'll often say, we're all about bringing people together. And I agree that that is a possibility. You know, they may, if everyone takes part, then maybe they'll all bond over it, and that's great. But if one person does and the other doesn't, then suddenly you start getting these divisions. And this happens a lot. You just have to go online, find these groups, find discussions about them, and you'll hear people talking about how a relationship was ruined or something along those lines. What else? So the claims of psychological harm, I think, are important to look at. And for the last 50 years, there have been claims of psychological harm. If you read chapter 8 of Margaret Singer's book, it's called Intruding into the Workplace. And that's because of the fact that a lot of these organizations will recruit people through companies and that sort of thing. But Singer speaks about PTSD, psychotic episodes, you know, stress-related illnesses, and various other things that have been reported. LifeSpring, there were a number of lawsuits against LifeSpring, often with very big payouts, you know, up to $800,000. And this is in the sort of 70s and 80s. And there were journal articles written in the 1970s and 1980s about people displaying manic type of symptoms, psychotic symptoms, that sort of thing. And so these claims have been made, and this hasn't been researched properly to get a good sense of how frequently these things occur. So the relationship between these claims and evidence for these claims, it's difficult. It's difficult to kind of say it was definitely caused by this. But if you read Kirsch and Glass's articles, they say it seems pretty clear that the seminar seemed to be the cause. How frequently it's happening is another question.
On the volunteer labor side of things, like when I started looking into some of these groups, I was astounded to find out. I had no idea that there were all these volunteers doing all of this work, because a lot of them seem like they should be high profit, like they're making quite a lot, or they're charging quite a lot for the seminars. So I think a lot of people who come across these types of seminars, maybe they'll just attend one and then go on with their life and look back on it and say that it was helpful in whatever ways. So the idea of it being cultic is pretty far from their mind. But to find out there can be in some of these organizations like this core group of people who are basically giving up most of their time to kind of serve the organization for no monetary remuneration, that was astounding to me. I had no idea that was happening.
Yeah, and I think people have different levels of interaction with these organizations. And it certainly seems for most people that the interaction is relatively brief. They can get something that they feel is positive out of that. We can talk about some of the studies on that as well. So yes, there's definitely different levels of interaction with the organizations. I think that the claims that relate to them being cult-like in some respect do relate to that smaller group of people who do spend a lot of time working for the organizations without being remunerated for it. Yeah.
And who become, yes, very heavily invested in defending those organizations and never hearing any criticisms, which of course we see in a lot of cults as well. And so you mentioned, you know, evidence-based research, and I wanted to ask you about what you can tell me about any peer-reviewed studies into the effectiveness of some of the approaches that these group awareness trainings are taking.
Okay, so the most recent peer-reviewed study that I can speak about is a study, it's called Psychological Effects of Participation in a Large Group Awareness Training. And it was published in 1989, and it was on the Forum. So this was the sort of follow-up seminar to EST. And so EST ran until, I think, 1981, and then the EST training ran until 1985, and then I think from 1985 until 1991, the training was changed, and the name was called the Forum. And so Werner Erhard was running Werner Erhard and Associates. If you read the study, it actually says, you know, there was a formal agreement with Werner Erhard for the study to be done. It was going to be done completely independently, which I think is a fantastic thing that he allowed them to just kind of get the study done. I assume that he thought that the results were going to be in favor of the Forum. And it was a very well-designed study. So it was a quasi-experimental design. There was a control group. There was a lot of work done to remove confounding variables. There were objective measures of a number of different variables that were compared between the experimental group and the control group. And the conclusions of the study were that in the short term, which was, I think, 4 to 6 weeks after participation, there were small changes to perceived sense of control. So participants felt like they were more in control, and very small changes to daily coping. And daily coping actually said that the participants were coping less well. So they were getting more frustrated with day-to-day activity. So that was the short-term finding. And then all the other measures, they found no short-term benefits or disadvantages. Long-term, which was 18 months after participation, they found no long-term differences between the control group and the experimental group. So that's the peer-reviewed study. You know, if you look at studies that a lot of these organizations have put on their websites and that sort of thing, the supposed independent research, none of these studies have been published in academic journals. They haven't tried to, as far as I'm aware, get anything else published in the last 30-odd years. And I think that is quite telling. I think if these organizations are offering benefits, they have a responsibility to themselves and the participants to do high-quality research on them. So these organizations are often not taken seriously by, you know, mainstream psychology and the mainstream academic community. They make very strong claims about what they can do. These are claims that should be, they're empirically testable claims. So if they claim that they're offering some sort of benefits and that these benefits are incredible and they're long-lasting, then do a study and demonstrate that that's the case. So it's a little bit unfair for them to kind of say, well, why is there all the skepticism about us if they aren't willing to do the research to demonstrate it?
Yes, indeed. And from a psychological perspective, many participants really feel they have experienced something transformative in these seminars. And I wondered what you could share about the concept of peripheral route persuasion, which I read about in some of your work, and how this operates at an extreme level in these groups.
Yes, and I don't like to undermine anyone's experience. I really just do feel that if somebody is going to take part, so if somebody feels like they've had a huge benefit and then they invite somebody else to participate and that other person doesn't have a benefit and there's a potential that there's going to be, there's a possibility of harm, my view is that anyone that participates needs to have as much accurate information as possible. And so if you have benefit or feel you benefit, I think you also need to think critically about the perception of that benefit. So when we speak about peripheral route persuasion, there was an article written, you know, in the early 1980s, but kind of key article was written in 1986 by Petty and Cacioppo. And it's basically about the elaboration likelihood model. And this is explaining how persuasion might work. And this is an article that's been cited nearly 17,000 times. I mean, it's really a very well accepted model within persuasion in mainstream psychology. So these are not people that have got any idea about problematic groups or whatever. They don't have an axe to grind. This is just their explanation. And basically what they say is that when you are persuading somebody, you can either persuade them using a lot of information and evidence and give them as much time as possible to think about it and reflect and that sort of thing. And they call that the central route. Or you can persuade people using the peripheral route. And the peripheral route essentially bypasses critical thinking. It uses shortcuts or heuristics. So things like, is the person telling me this? Do they seem to be like an authority? Then I should believe them. Do I feel good? So there's something called the affect heuristic. So affect meaning mood. So if you feel good when you're hearing something, then you're more likely to believe it. And there's all these sorts of things that can affect persuasion on the peripheral route if a person is not cognitively engaged. And they speak about two main things that affect whether a person is going to be persuaded using the central route or the peripheral route. And the two things are motivation and ability. So is a person motivated to think through the thing that they've just been told? So do they think it's worth their time doing it and that sort of thing? So for example, if you go to a doctor you're going to a doctor because you're not motivated to go to medical school to study all that stuff. It's not worth your time to do that. If you hire an architect, you know, you're hiring the architect, you may think that you could do it if you put all the time, but you're not motivated to figure that stuff out. You're going to outsource it to somebody else. So motivation is one of the things and ability is the other thing. So do you have the ability to work this thing out? So do you have the intelligence? And then also, do you have the time? So will you be able to work this thing out if you were given the time and space to do it? And what you see in large group awareness trainings is that motivation and ability are heavily undermined. So from the moment you get in there, you're basically told, you know, this seminar is about the things that you don't know that you don't know. So how can you possibly understand it if you don't even know what this thing is about? You're told to trust the process. You're made incredibly tired. So we get something that's referred to as ego depletion. So your prefrontal cortex is responsible for a lot of your critical thinking. The more tired you get, and it's also the part of your brain that uses the most energy. So if you're sitting there for 2-3 hours, very few breaks, huge amounts of information being processed, you can't write down, you can't discuss it with anyone else, you've got homework to do at night. I mean, it's not an environment that's designed to give you the ability to think carefully about everything that's being told to you. In terms of your motivation, they will say to you, come from your heart, not your head. Understanding is the booby prize. Like, thinking is devalued, and trusting the experience or trusting the process is elevated as a way of knowing. When you read Singer's description of leaders of these seminars, they all are very good at establishing themselves as authority figures. So you go into the seminar and you may see yourself as being kind of on the same level as this person. Within a short period of time, you're basically made to feel like you know nothing about what's about to go on. This person knows everything. They're often very well-dressed. They present themselves really well. They speak with a lot of authority. These things are creating an authority gap between the participants and the researchers. Additionally, what you, and I haven't spoken about this yet, but a lot of what takes place in LGATs are regression exercises. So guided visualization exercises are often used where you've got to sit down and think about something. And a lot of these exercises involve thinking about being a child, thinking of interactions with your parents when you were much smaller. A lot of these interactions can be quite distressing for a lot of people. But what people don't realize is that what that does is it's a form of priming. So children are far less likely to question authority figures. If you put yourself into the position of being a child, even if it's just for a little while, it makes you less likely to question. And the whole environment is kind of set up in a sort of children and parent dynamic where you've got this all-knowing leader and you become the children. And so in terms of the elaboration likelihood model, it seems that what they are doing is they are making it very unlikely that you're going to use the central route. Well, they certainly aren't creating conditions that facilitate central route persuasion. And they are maximizing the chances that you're going to employ peripheral route persuasion. And so one of the things that affects peripheral route persuasion, as I said, is an affective state, a mood or whatever. They know that on the final day, they're going to trigger this really powerful emotional experience. And if people aren't thinking about what's going on and you haven't written anything down, you're now going to associate that powerful positive experience with the information that you've been presented and with a lot of the obligations that you've been presented with. And there's something, and Daniel Kahneman speaks about this in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. So Daniel Kahneman is a psychologist. He won a Nobel Prize for economics in 2002. Great book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which is very much about using evidence or using heuristics. So very similar to the elaboration likelihood model. He speaks about the peak end rule, and he speaks about the experiencing versus the remembering self. And what he effectively says is that people often don't remember things as they occur. They remember things as they are at the end and how they are at the peak. And so if you go through this really stressful, difficult experience, and you're really tired and you can't write anything down and your memory's not going to be great, and then right at the end you're made to feel the best you've ever felt in your life before, you're quite likely to remember the events in a distorted way. And I think that that's something that people need to be aware of. Something else that I maybe just want to throw in here as well that aligns with this is there's research on something called reciprocal connection. So one of the rules that they often ask people to do, or they get people to do, is applause. And if you speak to anyone that's been to one of these seminars, there's a lot of applause. So we often think of ourselves as, we think of thinking happening in one direction, but it often kind of goes in two directions, and I'll explain what I mean. So, for example, if we are happy, we smile. But they've actually done studies that show that if you smile, it also makes you feel happy. So there was an experiment that they did where they got half of the group to put a pen in their mouth sideways while they were reading some Far Side cartoons, and half the group to put it in their mouth like forwards. So one group was kind of, their facial muscles were kind of in a smiling position. One group were in a frowning position. And then they just got them to rate how funny they thought the cartoons were. And the people that were sort of smiling found them a lot funnier. Another good example of this is they did an experiment where they said to these groups of people, we want you to test out this audio equipment. And so they played this information in the background, but they kind of said, don't really worry about that. Half the group, they said, we want you to nod your heads up and down. And the other group, they said, we want you to shake your heads from side to side to elicit distortions in the sound. And what they were really trying to see is whether the people nodding would agree with the information more than the people that were shaking their heads. And they did. So if you're nodding, it's associated with agreement. If you're shaking your heads from side to side, it's association with disagreement. And so they found that that unconsciously had a big effect on people. What you see in LGATs is whenever the participants have a breakthrough, or what they call a breakthrough, there'll be a huge amount of applause. But typically that breakthrough is when the person starts to agree with what the trainer has been saying. So they've been resisting, they've been kind of going, I disagree, whatever. And then they finally start agreeing, and then there's this huge applause. So if you're tired, you will be far more likely to associate that with, I agree with what has just been said. So I mean, this has been quite a long answer to your question, but there's a lot going on that participants may not be aware of. They may not be aware of how their minds work and how they've come to the decision that this was a good thing or not.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And you've mentioned it a couple of times now, the fact that participants aren't allowed to write anything down. And the first time I heard that, I was really surprised by that too. Not that I should be surprised by anything anymore, because it would just seem to undermine the idea that you're there and you're finding out all this amazing stuff that's going to help you in the future if you can't write any of it down to refer back to later, and that you've got all this homework and you're not able to refer to any notes or anything. So I just always found that really interesting.
So often people will take part in, and I'm not necessarily referring to large group awareness trainings, but in any sort of group, and they might say, oh, I didn't think that there was anything brainwashing about it involved at all. And you kind of say, well, do you know anything about thought reform? Do you know about how it occurs? Do you know what sorts of people have been vulnerable to it in the past? It's not just, you know, fools that get taken in. Do you know how do you know what to look for? And they'll say, well, no. And so you kind of say, so you're basing your feeling confidence on a feeling, which is literally the opposite of thinking critically about something. And yet the claim is that I can think critically and I'm not being manipulated by heuristics. If you don't know how the processes work, then it's very easy and it's very comforting to go, well, there's no way I could be vulnerable.
Yeah. And I say that a lot about cults as well. I think it's a comfort to think that you might not be fooled or that you would be immune to these types of manipulations. But I think most people probably just haven't come across the particular cult that would have got them at that particular point in their life when they would have been most vulnerable to it. And I've looked at many cults that have incredibly intelligent high achievers involved. So yes, I never think that it's about that.
And even in my own case, I mean, the fact that I looked critically at what was happening in the LGAT, there were a lot of reasons that I was particularly vigilant at that time in my life. And it wasn't just my knowledge of bipolar disorder and whatever. There were a lot of things. And I think that played a huge role in me not kind of going, oh, this is amazing, like everyone else seemed to do.
Right. So I recently had an episode on the podcast with journalist Emma Lehman about the troubled teen industry. And so I wondered if you could also tell us about the links between the TTI and LGATs.
Sure. I mean, it's very simple. So I imagine a lot of people have now watched the Netflix documentary, The Program. And I think that that seems to have done an incredible job of showing the big picture in terms of what goes on in those schools. And again, they're very similar to each other. So for those that know about the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs, so that WASP group that was originally sort of founded as an overseer of a lot of those schools and educational programs or whatever you want to call them, an organization closely related to WASP was an organization called Resource Realizations. So Resource Realizations was specifically responsible for the running of the seminars that you see in episode two. So the workshops that the students are expected to take part in. And the person that owned and ran Resource Realizations was somebody named David Gilcrease, and he was a LifeSpring trainer, I believe for about 10 years or so. So EST and LifeSpring are the two organizations that are mentioned in every journal article that I've read that was written about large group awareness trainings in the 1970s and 1980s. The LGAT that I took part in 2010 was very close to LifeSpring, and it took some exercises directly from EST, but a lot of exercises directly from LifeSpring. So what's being used on these vulnerable teenagers in the troubled teen industry seems to be pretty much a carbon copy of LifeSpring seminars. And these are seminars that were sued multiple times, eventually went out of business, you know, under that name at least. And there may have been some screening of people to take part in those seminars. It's almost like there's reverse screening for the group of teenagers that are taking part in these seminars. So a lot of them may be diagnosed with mental health conditions. They may be experiencing various challenges. They're very young as well, so their brains aren't fully developed. So you've got a particularly vulnerable group of people who are coming from an already hostile situation, and then you're putting them in these seminars that have been, you know, sued for causing psychological harm to healthy adults in the past. And it's very worrying.
Yes, very worrying. What do you think can be done to better protect people from the potential harms that your research finds with these organizations?
I think that there just needs to be more transparency. I think that if the organizations have got the best interests of participants at heart, then there needs to be open discussion about the criticisms, because these criticisms have been around for 50 years. So to kind of try to not have these things spoken about, or to say, oh, these things hardly ever happen, or these aren't really problems, or it's an aggrieved person, or something you frequently hear is these criticisms are coming from people who haven't taken part in the seminars. If you go into an LGAT, the entire mindset is about confronting people about various things in their life and getting them to take responsibility. So I think that the same approach should be applied to these organizations. They should be confronted. They should look honestly at themselves, and they should try to account for it, or to make changes if necessary, or to do the research to actually figure out, you know, who is being harmed. If anyone, get some independent researchers to look at this. Do they actually add benefits? So the 1989 study found no, long-term, there isn't any benefit. So if somebody is going to take part and they're going to provide informed consent, my opinion is that they need to have a fair understanding of the potential benefits and a fair understanding of the potential risks. And in my view, the potential risks are not limited to possible psychological harm. The potential harm may be that you behave impulsively, that you become obsessed and you alienate yourself from people that you've been close to, because there are consistent claims that these sorts of things are happening. So rather than shutting people down when these discussions come up, why not have those discussions? Why not address them? I think that's a fair thing to ask.
It sounds pretty fair to me. I think that brings me to the end of the questions I had for you, but is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to mention?
I think a useful thing for people to kind of look at is the neurobiology. And I mean, I'm not going to go into this in any detail now, especially after speaking for this much time, but this is really what my research is about. So kind of providing a neurobiological explanation for the relationship between what happens in the seminars and the results. And by the results, I mean the good, in inverted commas, results. So the kind of transformational type feelings, the elevated states, but also the claimed negative results. So things like depression, there have been claims of suicide, psychosis, those kind of things. My research offers a possible explanation for that. And so I think that that's worth people looking into as well. Again, at my website, you can find some information on that. And if it's shut down, then you probably know why.
And there will be links to all of your work in the show notes. So yes, and on the website, so everyone will be able to find them very easily. So, John, thank you so much for your time today. It's been incredibly interesting, and it's great to have your perspective on the psychological perspective of how these organizations operate. I think it's something that we probably haven't spoken about enough on the podcast, so I really appreciate it, and thank you.
Cheers. Thank you so much.
You can find links to Dr. John Hunter's work in the show notes. And stick around now for a special bonus segment discussing an earlier article John wrote about the links between LGATs and Fight Club. As a film enthusiast, I found this subject absolutely fascinating, but I appreciate it's a bit off topic for some listeners, so I've saved it for the end for those who might also find it interesting. I'll definitely be watching Fight Club again with John's ideas in mind.
You've drawn parallels between LGATs and Fight Club. Tell me more about that.
Okay, so this is a slightly difficult one to explain. So if you go to my website, johnhunterphd.com, you'll find links to a lot of my work. So there is an illustrated essay on this. So I took part in LGAT in 2010. I studied them for the next 2 years a lot, just really trying to figure out what I could. And in 2012, I heard that Chuck Palahniuk, the author of Fight Club, was a big supporter of the forum. And so I thought, oh, that's really interesting. So I decided, okay, well, let me try and figure out something about this. So I went and I watched the movie. And while I was watching it, because I was very familiar with people involved in the industry, I started noticing a lot of parallels. And as somebody with bipolar disorder, this is not necessarily a good thing. So when you start seeing links between things all over the place, the smart thing to do is to kind of go, maybe I'm a little bit psychotic, maybe I'm delusional, I'm seeing like connections where there aren't any. But the next day I went and I spoke to my psychologist and I said to her, I said, I've found these hidden messages in Fight Club. And so I think she, I saw her kind of just writing something down, and I think she obviously thought that I was maybe moving into a bit of a manic state. And I had it in my head, but I didn't really make too much of it. At the end of my PhD, I included an appendix so somebody that had a good understanding of LGATs could see whether it made sense or not. And nobody really got back to me. And then a couple of years after that, in 2019, I decided I'd just write the essay out as clearly as I could. And I sent it to a guy who runs a website on David Fincher's work, so the director of Fight Club. And he got back to me and he said, no, this all makes complete sense. So for sort of 7 years, I was thinking maybe I'm just nuts. So the essay is called LGATs and Fight Club Dissecting a Delusion. So with that introduction, so I think that the book and the movie are about Chuck Palahniuk, who kind of represents an everyman. So any person getting involved in one of these organizations, thinking that it's great, and then having to come to terms with some of the information about it that maybe is not so pleasant. So if you read kind of about his association, there are a number of publications which say that it was while he was taking part in the forum in 1989 that he became inspired to become a writer. That's when he went home and started writing Feitler. So he has made that statement. So that association kind of exists. He's also said in separate publications, he said that if he is writing a satire, then he's usually satirizing himself. And he literally says, I'm satirizing the self-help groups that I got involved in. He says, I was the person with an IKEA catalog in my drawer. So making quite specific reference to Fight Club there. He also says there's a documentary of him online, and he says that horrors are often metaphors for things that society can't talk about out loud. So he kind of says, and he says that the Frankenstein monster was actually about the Industrial Revolution. So the idea that you can use a book to comment on something that maybe is difficult to talk about. And the organizations that I think he's commenting on have got a history of being quite litigious, of suing anyone that they feel is saying something negative about them. All right, so what is the story about? He meets Tyler, okay, and I think that Tyler represents Werner Erhard, and I'll explain why I think that that's the case. And Tyler is this person who shows him a new way of viewing the world. And I'm not the only person who's made the connection. So Roger Ebert, who's that famous film reviewer from Chicago, when he was reviewing Fight Club in 1999, he says, Tyler seems to be Werner Erhard, like a charismatic bully. That's kind of how he describes him. And Ebert actually says, none of Tyler's, you know, the people that follow him become stronger or freer. They're reduced to pathetic cultists. That's the words that he actually uses. The character played by Edward Norton, I think, represents Paulinick. In the screenplay, he's actually referred to as Jack. So Jack is the name of the character. Even on the back of the DVD, he's referred to as Jack. Erhard's original name was Jack Rosenberg. So Werner Erhard was created by Jack Rosenberg. Tyler Durden was created by Jack, which is something you kind of find out later in the movie. Tyler, as we see, splices single frames of pornography into family films. So that idea of putting hidden messages into a film is something that the character is actually doing. I think that there's something kind of meta going on there, and that Paulinick and Fincher are doing the same thing with the book and the movie. So they are splicing sort of hidden messages into the film. And I'll kind of give you a couple of examples of that. So for example, Edward Norton turns to the camera at one point and he says, Tyler works as a banquet waiter at the luxurious Pressman Hotel. So Stephen Pressman is a journalist who wrote a book called Outrageous Betrayal in 1993. And I think that this is one of the books that Paulinick may have read. So this book is about Werner Erhard. Okay, it's a biography of Werner Erhard that's not very complimentary. And so I think that that book is one of the books that Paulinick read after 1989. And he was kind of like, oh, maybe there's some problems. Okay, so he refers to the Pressman Hotel. In that book, it mentions where Erhard lived. So he lived in Franklin Street in San Francisco. And there's a chapter called Nightmare on Franklin Street. It's mentioned a number of times. In the movie, the first scene and the last scene are in Franklin Street. So it comes up a couple of times. So after Edward Norton escapes from the police, he runs down the road, he's in his boxes. He stopped and he turns and he looks up to his right at a bus shelter and it says Franklin Street. So I think that that's one of these things that's kind of been spliced in. A little bit earlier in the film, and you can see how my strange mind works here, but a little bit earlier in the film, when he goes to basically turn in the group, so he's kind of worked out that there's problems with the group that he's involved in, the Space Monkeys and what they're doing, he goes to the police station and he goes to the counter and he says, there's this group responsible for all of these problematic things. And then there's a changeover before the scene where the police threaten to cut his balls off. And in that changeover, something flashes on the screen. And the thing that flashes is something that says Emery Street. And again, if you know much about the industry, Stuart Emery was the first CEO of Est. And he was also the founder of an organization called Actualizations, which is one of the earlier LGATs. All right, then you look at the Fight Club. So what is happening in the Fight Club? You've got these really brutal interactions between people, two people at a time, that lead to some sort of enlightenment. If you see what happens in an OGAT, you've got a participant holding a mic, you've got a trainer holding a mic, and often you have these very brutal interactions and they lead to breakthroughs or enlightenment of some sort. As you arrive in Fight Club, what does Tyler do? The first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. Then they run through a bunch of rules that you're supposed to agree to. The same thing happens in LGATs. All right, then we've got, who's the person that kind of interferes with his involvement in these groups? The person is Marla Singer. So who is that maybe a parallel for? Dr. Margaret Singer. So that book was published in 1995. So remember, it says that he wrote this book. Sorry, he was inspired to write it in 1989. He didn't publish it until 1996. So what happened between that period of time? Well, in 1991, there was an episode on 60 Minutes that was very critical of Earhart. In 1993, there was this book by Pressman. And in 1995, there was this book by Margaret Singer. And so she's a very well-known person who's commented on cults. She was head of the APA committee appointed in 1983 by the American Psychological Association. At one point in the movie, Edward Norton says to Marla while he's trying to get her to go on a bus, "They think you're some kind of threat. I can't explain it right now." I really think, and the idea that Tyler doesn't come out when Marla's around, and it causes him a lot of anxiety to hear them having sex. And them having sex, in my view, is the interaction between these two conflicting ideas. You've got Earhart and you've got his enjoyment of these trainings, and then you've got the information that's being provided by Singer. And there's conflict when they are together. And so you've got this kind of cognitive dissonance that I think he's trying to sort of work through. What else can I say about this? Oh, okay, so homework assignments. So you see in the movie, Tyler handing out homework assignments to people. And I mean, again, this is something that happens in a lot of LGATs. You have the Raymond K. Hessel scene. So that scene where they go into the convenience store, they pull the guy out, they put him on his knees, they put a gun in the back of his head, and Tyler says, "Raymond, you're going to die." And the guy's screaming and begging and all this sort of thing. Eventually, Tyler lets him go and he runs off into the night, and Edward Norton says, "What was the point of that? I feel sick." And Tyler says, "Tomorrow he's going to have the greatest day of his life. His breakfast will taste better than anything that you and I have ever tasted." In Est and in the sort of more recent incarnations of Est, they have something called the fear exercise, where they literally get people to visualize something incredibly frightening. When you hear descriptions of it, people are crying and screaming and whatever. And right at the end, they remove the stress and they say it's actually just kind of a joke and, you know, that sort of thing. And people feel amazing afterwards. But even on a more macro level, what occurs in LGATs is this period of stress. Removal of the stress and this kind of euphoria. Then you've got the space monkeys. So these are all these people who are doing all this work. They're living in a house that's owned by Tyler / Edward Norton, and they're cleaning pots and pans, and they believe that they're getting free enlightenment. And we've spoken about people that are volunteers and that are kind of doing all this stuff. And if you read Pressman's book again, there literally were a group of people living in the Franklin house where Earhart lived, you know, working for free, cleaning the pots and pans, literally the same wording, cleaning pots and pans in the Franklin house. So you've got this kind of, it seems fair to make the claim that this is commentary. I don't think that it's delusional. I think that it is kind of supported by evidence. Then you see the name tags that are used. So, and I know I'm kind of jumping around a little bit here, but the meetings that Norton goes to at the beginning, there's a lot of guided visualization. He's told to go to his cave and find his power animal, and it's a little penguin. And that sort of thing happens a lot. There's, as I say, the name tags and that sort of thing. Then I think that there's commentary on the silencing of critics. So at one point in the movie, you've got this government official who stands up and says, "We're going to do something about this organization and this group of people responsible for these acts of vandalism around whatever." And then you see Tyler and the group of people pulling him into the bathroom, putting tape over his mouth, putting a knife at his neck and saying, "You're going to publicly state that there is no underground group or these guys are going to take your balls." I mean, that may be a comment on the litigious nature of some of these organizations. Okay, and I think if we look at some of the other jobs that are kind of mentioned, so Jack or Edward Norton's profession, he says, "I'm a recall coordinator." One of the major criticisms of large group awareness trainings is that people are harmed, and this is a criticism that's been made quite often. People are harmed, but they will not change the way that they're doing things. They will rather just pay people off in the event that something goes wrong. So it's more profitable for them to keep doing what they're doing and paying people off in the event of a disaster. And again, this is a criticism that's been made by Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. Singer made it. A number of people have made this criticism. It's not coming from me. I'm just drawing the links between these things. So what is Edward Norton's job? He's a recall coordinator. So what does that involve? And he's speaking to a woman that he's sitting next to on a plane when he explains this. And he says, well, I work for a car company, and say my car is driving from A to B and something goes wrong and the whole car explodes and kills everyone inside. Do we do a recall of the line of cars or not? And he says, well, I've got to apply a formula. And the formula is, I basically look at the number of cars in the fleet, the cost of the recall, the chances of a failure, and I do a calculation. And if the cost of a recall is more than the cost of the payoffs for the possible failures, we don't do a recall. So to me, that could be a commentary on that. When Jack, the character, finally starts recognizing that there's a problem is when Bob is killed, and there's a possible relationship with Bob as well. There was a employee named Bob who wanted to be a soldier for the EST organization. And you've got Bob who wants to be a soldier as well. And Bob gets killed and they bring him back to the house, and all of the space monkeys are kind of standing around and they're saying, well, what should we do? And they say, we've got to get rid of the evidence. Let's bury him in the garden. And what Edward Norton says, we're not going to bury him in the garden. This isn't a piece of evidence. This is a person, and he's dead now because of us. Do you understand this? And this is when it seems like he's starting to realize that there's something seriously not right about what's going on, that these space monkeys are just doing everything that they can to protect the group and are not acknowledging problems because they feel like their mission is more important. Kind of moving right to the end of the movie, I think that the sort of final scene where he puts a gun in his mouth is possibly a metaphor for having to let a part of himself die in order to be free. And before he does it, he turns to Tyler and he says, my eyes are open. And then he shoots himself. And at the end, you see Marla kind of coming in and the whole world sort of falling apart. Like all the buildings are collapsing and he's holding hands with Marla. And my interpretation of that is that this must have been an incredibly difficult thing for him to do. Maybe it did kind of cause his world to fall apart. But the holding hands with Marla to me is a symbol of a reconciliation with the evidence and with reality and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a bit of a strange thought to throw in there, but that was my interpretation of the movie.
I let you take that all the way through because I found that so fascinating. This, my mum's dog that I'm dog sitting at the moment. And I'm quite a big Chuck Palahniuk fan. I've got a number of his books on my shelf. So I was disappointed when you said he was a fan of Forum, but then hearing you talk about the way that he maybe fed this into, well, it sounds quite likely, fed it through this film. I'm going to go back and watch it again with that in mind. And I can also see how watching that with seeing all those messages come through must have felt like, was that a delusion or something to you? I can just see how that would have happened.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, as somebody who's lived with bipolar disorder for a long time, you really have to question, if you start thinking something and you can objectively see this is not a normal thought to have, it's kind of wise to go and ask somebody else about it. And that's why, I mean, literally for 7 years, I was just like, well, maybe I'm wrong, even though it clearly seems like it's, but I may be wrong about this, yeah.
But that you would sort of need your specific level of knowledge about these things to even see it. Like, I think, yeah, it's really, really interesting.
You can access early and ad-free episodes and support the production of this independent podcast via Patreon, patreon.com/LTASpod, or with a one-off donation or merch purchase. You can also grab a copy of my book, Do As I Say. That link's in the show notes too. This episode of Let's Talk About Sects was produced by me, Sarah Steele. Music was by Joe Gould. This was the final episode for season 6 of Let's Talk About Sects, but I already have some incredible interviews lined up to bring you over the next few months until we get to the next season of the show. So thanks for joining me, and hope to catch you again next episode.